I'm after starting up with something, I forget what I was talking about. However, this is not a bad one. Not a bad little number at all. I don't know where I got the years from, because I can't write music. I am a happy English lad, I love my royalty. If they were short a penny on a packet of fags, now they'd only have to ask me. I love old England in the east, I love her in the west. From Jordan's streams to Derry's walls, I love old England best.
Writer Brendan Behan in full flight there. Behan's larger-than-life personality, his love of singing, fighting and outrage, not only added to his fame and notoriety in life, but has proven to be an impediment to the appraisal and celebration of his work in current times. A new book, Reading Brendan Behan, puts the emphasis firmly back on the plays, poems and prose of the writer, while each contributor seeks to disentangle the writer from the work. Reading Brendan Behan is edited by John McCourt, but I'm joined in studio by two of the contributors, Michael Cronin and Derek Hand. Derek, why is Behan and his work so fundamentally interconnected? Because surely there are many writers with big personalities.
Well, absolutely. I think I was thinking about this, and I think that in the 20th century, in the mid-20th century, when Behan was writing, perhaps it wasn't about telling the national story, it was about telling the story of the self, of the person or the personality. I think for Behan himself, I think the idea of his own selfhood, who he was, became entwined with his work, because it became each medium, as it were, became a way for him to express himself.
Are you saying that that was the style of in Europe and in the world in literature at the time?
No, I don't think so. I just think that in many ways, Behan's energy, as he said himself, sort of, or as Wilde said, Oscar Wilde, that he put his genius into his life and only his talent into his work, that perhaps Behan sort of took that motto and sort of made it his own for the 50s and the 60s. I think it's the idea of using art and Behan using art as a way of making himself. And sort of he used his life, he used the voices that he heard and the stories of his own upbringing to sort of fill out his art.
And was that new and innovative at the time?
Not really. I think Paddy Kavanagh did the same in The Green Fool, Joyce in Ulysses, Stephen Dedalus is a version of Joyce. I think the story of the self is the one to be told in the 20th century, and Behan sort of does it. So it's not new, as it were. I think what was interesting about Behan, and it doesn't happen for everyone, is that his fame, his personality, became just as equally as important as the work itself.
Michael, we're talking there about him writing in the 1950s, so we're in the middle of the 20th century. And John McCourt, in the introduction to Reading Brendan Behan, he writes about Behan being at sea in mid-century Dublin, that his peers, Behan said disparagingly, were interested in writing about their hungry bogs and the great scarcity of crumpet. So is that Behan being just having fun, or is that the way
he
felt?
I think there's an element of truth. There was the state was very deeply conservative. It, you know, the dominant ideology mixed the worst bits of nationalism and Catholicism and capitalism. The dominant culture was censorious and puritanical and repressive. But of course, artists don't, you know, need the encouragement of the state. Artists and writers produce some of their best work, you know, contra a very kind of dominant state. And so there's exaggeration there, but I mean, I think the main refutation of what Behan says there is Behan's own work. Mm. Behan's Borstal Boy and the two plays and his other work wouldn't exist if there wasn't actually a very vibrant counterculture there in Dublin when he was writing. He was so dependent on support from various artists and writers and institutions, Sean O'Fallon, John Ryan, Carolyn Swift, mm. Pike Theatre, The Bell, Gail Lynn, the Irish Language Theatre, Martin O'Kine when he was in prison and so on. So actually his own work demonstrates the opposite of what he's saying. That yes, of course, there was this repressive dominant culture, but running against that, there is this very vibrant kind of what we'd call a counterculture, I guess.
Yes, because Derek, I suppose, but when there is a very dominant culture, there has to be an avant-garde or something pushing against it.
But I think as well, and it goes back to that self, the idea of the self, but I think his problem might have been is that a lot of art or that kind of stereotypical view of Ireland was rural-based. And so he comes from the north side of Dublin City. He comes from a certain working class background. He wants to bring that into his art, bring it onto stage in his plays and bring it into his novel, Borstal Boy. So he's trying to, I suppose, complicate a certain sense of Irishness. Mm-hmm. So that idea of, you know, our world is agricultural and so on, I think that's what he's sort of attacking, is that view of Ireland as in some way backward, rural, agricultural based, the west of Ireland and so on. He wants to complicate it. He wants to sort of show that there are different types of Ireland's possible.
Mm. Now, you were talking about his reputation or the reputations that get in the way of his art sometimes. Mm. And in an interview with Eamon Andrews, he talks about his fame and how he feels about his own fame.
Now, you did say to a journalist at one time two things at the one occasion. You said everyone should be successful for 1 month, but that's all.
That's all. I believe that, Eamon.
Why?
Because after that it gets a bit of a nonsense. You can't go in for a drink. You can't walk up the street without some person, usually that hasn't bought a book you've written or hasn't paid into a play you've seen. And the cash customers, of course, are quite welcome. They can shake my foot as well as my hand.
Brenda Behan there talking to Eamon Andrews. Derek, John McCourt says that Brenda Behan left behind him a trail of reputations that dwarfed his literary output. Is that something that you agree with?
Well, I think this book is about going back, as you said in the intro, to the text itself. Look, I think Brendan Behan died very young. Who knows what he might have
41.
Produced, 41. Mm-hmm. In that Eamon Andrews interview, Eamon Andrews asks him and says, if someone was to talk about you in 50 years' time, what would you like them to say? I'd like them to say that I'm looking very well, thank you very much. So he had no sense of his own mortality in that way. I think there's only a few texts, right? So that's one issue. I think that the cult of personality after his death meant that what we see on stage in brilliant performances by Neil Tobin and others is Brendan Behan and not the work. I mean, it is interesting that we haven't seen the hostage or the queer fellow, which is a pity. But I think the personality perhaps got out of control. I mean, in one way, I think that can happen with fame, that you think you're in control of this version of yourself and suddenly you no longer have control. And I think that's what happened to Brendan Behan, sadly.
But I think it's also about ways of reading Behan. And in one way, I think the emphasis on framing the work as autobiographical downplays the degree to which he was an artist, the degree to which he sort of worked to sculpt the material of his life into aesthetic texts and works of art. And I think it's also a kind of recoil from the radicalism of his politics. And I'm not talking about, you know, his youthful involvement with the IRA and violence. He himself grew very sceptical of that. So, and the work is, you know, expresses that scepticism. I'm talking more about the sort of politics to which he remained committed throughout his life, a politics that was socialist, that was republican, that was revolutionary. And that was seeded in a kind of Irish socialist republican tradition, but was very internationalist in its horizon. And I think safely corralling the work kind of within as just kind of memoirs, just autobiography, is a way of kind of a kind of an expression of a certain kind of allergy, as it were, to that kind of radicalism of that politics.
Now, you both find in your essays, in reading Brendan Behan, Borstal Boy has an awful lot to be explored in it. Michael, there are three Brendan Behans in Borstal Boy. Tell me about the three.
Well, that goes back to what I was just saying about the fact that he, you know, we can read it as just a sort of transcription of what his younger life self, or we can sort of see how this is a work that is drawing on various traditions in Irish writing, the Buildings Roman, the novel, the coming of age novel, going back to people like Joyce, but drawing on all sorts of other oral traditions as well. And one way of seeing how this novel has been sort of sculpted and shaped is by disentangling these three figures. Brendan Behan, the author who, 10, 15 years later, is looking back and working with this material over a long period of time. Brendan, the narrator who is telling his story and often inhabiting this kind of double consciousness, whether he's talking it one way to the other characters, the other boys, the prison guards, and at the same time talking to us, as it were, saying something quite different. So it's Brendan the narrator, and then there's Brendan, who is the sort of protagonist. And there's all sorts of interesting kind of diversions or variations between those. You know, the character, Brendan, who's being all very kind of macho and at the same time being incredibly sort of vulnerable, and particularly when he's first in Borstal.
Brendan, the character in the novel who goes to through the penal system in Britain because of his IRA activities. There are three penal institutions
moments,
he goes through.
Yeah.
And there is an evolution too in his politics as he goes through the institutions.
I think so. In many ways, yes, there is. I mean, he sort of learns the liberal lessons of, I mean, common sort of cause in terms of all of these people are working class. So forgetting about being Irish or English or British and so on, they share that sort of common background and hopefully common goals of progression. But there's also in many ways, and it's interesting you say there are three beings in that text, I would say only three, that in many ways he's constantly playing a role, you know, and in a necessary way. And it goes back to that idea of self-making. I mean, he's constantly telling lies, like white lies, let us say, then big sort of lies. He's nice to people. He will sort of turn on them when he's with others and so on. All of this as acts of survival in many ways. So he does learn these kind of liberal lessons, but something has constantly been withheld as well, the true Brendan Behan, that perhaps he's never fully sort of shown in that sort of text. So I think his ideological politics are exposed to other ideas, but I don't think he actually loses them. I think in many ways they become refined. And perhaps more powerful for him as a character.
Michael, your essay is called Eros and Liberation, the Homoerotic Body in Borstal Boy. Mm-hmm. And this is the idea that you had seen an earlier version of Borstal Boy, and where he has a more rougher, more unrefined, more coarse view on homosexuality. And then this is more refined in the finished book. Can you go through his progression there?
Okay, so what I quote is an extract from an earlier draft of the novel. I didn't actually see it. I was citing from Colbert Carney's book from the 70s. And so there, that is, in one way, it's much more explicit than the actual published novel, Borstal Boy. It's much more open, much more direct. He's the narrator, Brendan, says, myself and the other boys and young men in Borstal, we had sex together. At the same time, that sort of admission is covered under all sorts of qualifications and all sorts of kind of categorizations of sex and people. So there's a distinction between what sociologists later call situational homosexuality, i.e. they had sex because there was like no women around, as opposed to some sort of more real kind of homosexuality. And then there's a kind of
categorization. Which is seen as effeminate kind of homosexuality,
right. Yes.
Isn't it?
Exactly, because
yes.
That goes then with a kind of categorization of people. He distinguishes between him and the other young men in Borstal as being sort of manly, as opposed to the kind of effeminate, camp, dandy kind of gay or queer figure. Now, Brendan is very keen to be very open-minded and tolerant about the camp dandy figure. Fair play to him, off he does his own thing, but also very clear to distance himself from that figure. So what we see in the published edition then of Borstal Boy, we don't have anything as we could say, well, it's much less kind of explicit, it's much less direct, it's more sort of, you know, subdued and inhibited in some ways. But my argument is that in a sense what we see in Borstal Boy is actually kind of more interesting, more radical, more challenging in some ways, because all those kind of types of people and distinguishing between different types of people and identities is just kind of gone.
Even between male and female and gender or sexuality.
Exactly. And not even so, I'm
I sort of draw on his contemporary, the theorist Marcuse, Herbert Marcuse, who distinguishes between sexuality and eros. And for Marcuse, there's no such thing as sexual liberation. So long as we're using this concept of sexuality, we can never be liberated. We need this thing that he calls eros, which means the whole body stops becoming stops being a kind of instrument of labour and becomes a kind of site of pleasure. And that's a kind of utopian idea in Marcuse. We haven't had it, and, you know, we still haven't got it, but it's an idea that we can aspire to. So what we see in Borstal Boy then, around this figure particularly, this figure that he calls, Brendan, the narrator, calls Charlie, if we look carefully, we don't see any description of this as a relationship that we would describe as a gay relationship. There is no sex between them described. But if we look carefully at the language and the kind of cadences and the rhythm of the language, there we sort of see this kind of intense kind of passion. We see an eroticism, but we also see care and nurture and tenderness and solidarity. And that's kind of the exciting thing, the way in which the erotic, the homoerotic, is not something that is sort of distinctive, separated from life. It is sort of part of the whole spectrum of kind of human connection and human needs, and therefore in that way becomes sort of political in this quite different, radical way.
Mm. And Derek, is his socialism similar in that sense that he sees the boys who worked in the Liverpool docks he might have bombed, well, before he went into prison, that he sees this as a common cause in from his socialist perspective?
I think so. I think that at the end of the day, he realised that sort of empire is a system, as is the Irish state or Irish nationalism in that kind of way. But I don't think he gives up on the idea of struggle towards a kind of better future. Mm-hmm. I mean, what for me is interesting about the end of Borstal Boy, and this is where he does sort of, I think, sort of move on from his contemporaries. I mean, Joyce, Dedalus leaves at the end of Portrait, Beckett goes into exile, O'Casey goes into exile, Terry Flynn, Paddy Kavanagh's character, escapes to Dublin, as it away, from the stony grey soil of Monaghan. But Behan's character, Brendan, returns home and does so in an excitedly passionate way, naming all the things that he sees in Dublin Bay, Raheny and Baldoyle, and all these things that he can't even see, various sort of landscapes. So that return, I think, is interesting, because that, and it links in with Michael's idea of the homoerotic as something that we haven't actually perhaps fully embraced in that way, but that's what Behan's work in Borstal Boy particularly is, moving towards that future that he doesn't know what it is, but he's excited to move towards it nonetheless.
Well, to find out more, people will have to read Reading Brendan Behan, which is edited by John McCourt, and it's published by Cork University Press. Derek Hand and Michael Cronin, thank you very much.